From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The biggest events in sports, the Olympics, the Super Bowl, Terry O'Neill has produced them for television. O'Neill is a 15-year veteran of ABC and CBS Sports. On this edition of Fresh Air, O'Neill on the game behind the game. Also today, I talk with novelist Katherine Dunn. Her new book, Geek Love, follows a young couple who breed their own freak show. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Chuck Berry, and book critic John Leonard reviews the new collection of short stories by Soviet writer Tatiana Tolstoya, the great-grandniece of Leo Tolstoy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Television has changed how we watch sports. One of the people who's changed the way TV covers sports is my guest, Terry O'Neill. He got his start working for ABC Sports in 1972. As an ABC producer, he won two Emmys for his work with NCAA football and the 1980 Winter Olympics. From 1981 to 87, O'Neill was the head of CBS Sports, where he won two more Emmys as the producer of the NFL broadcasts. Now O'Neill heads his own TV production company, which produces the ESPN program The Sports Reporters. Terry O'Neill has written a new book called The Game Behind the Game, High Stakes, High Pressure in Television Sports. The presentation of sports on TV changed dramatically during the 15 years O'Neill was at the networks.
Football used to be covered with as few as five or six cameras, and that really changed in 1970 with the advent of Monday Night Football, where for the first time in prime time, ABC gave it a big look with 10 or 11 cameras, as many as five or six videotape machines. And it got to the point in the last Super Bowl I did where we had 23 cameras and 11 videotape machines. So there's virtually nothing you can't isolate with the level of facilities we enjoy now.
As the number of cameras have changed and you have more locations to put them in, has the whole idea of what to shoot changed also?
It changed, but slower than you'd think. As late as 1980, you might be stunned to find out that television production crews came to town and had no contact whatever with the coaches and players. They picked up their information in the newspapers and maybe from a public relations man. And on that basis, they had a very arm's-length view of the game, not an intimate view as we tried to instill with a new system in 1981. And now it is common procedure for all networks to do as we started in 81, and that is to have regular Saturday meetings the day before the game with coaches and players so you actually know which plays to expect and therefore which isolates to plot into your camera coverage.
So when you plot the isolates into your camera coverage, what exactly does that mean?
Well, there's a typewritten scheme that's three or four pages long that every cameraman and every videotape operator has, and it's very much like the coach's ready list that you see coaches carry on the sidelines. It has plays according to situation, down and distance, who has the ball, which direction the ball is moving, whether it's a scrimmage play or a punt play or a field goal or a kickoff. Short yardage versus an expected pass play. And according to those situations, everybody has an assignment on every play, and they go to it automatically just before the snap of the ball.
When you first started the system where the producers would meet with the coaches and players before a broadcast, were the coaches reluctant to reveal too much information, afraid that it might be shared with their opposing team?
They were just reluctant in general. You know, we were strangers in a strange land because television had never really shown this level of interest in the game, in the techniques of the game. Some coaches welcomed it because for years their decisions had been misrepresented on television, so they saw it as a chance to get some truth on the air for a change. But like any human endeavor, it took regular contact and a certain trust to build before we really got the most inside kind of information.
Getting back again to what the camera is shooting, I think it was your idea to pull back a little bit and shoot wider angles of the game.
Terry, it was, but not solely my idea. I can recall the earliest sessions I had with John Madden where we could sit for hours and hours in a coach's film room and watch the game as coaches watch it, which is to say, one shot with all 22 men available, visible on the screen, but projected onto an entire wall so that the players were large enough to be understandable. And when Madden said, why can't we show the game this way on television, I tried to explain, John, if we shrank this very large picture down to a 17-inch television screen, people could barely see the tiny ant figures running across their screens. But it occurred to me, if we had a device, a kind of a roadmap, to draw them a pattern, a pass pattern, or some sort of indicator as to which players to watch, that yes, we could shoot the game wider. And this was the genesis of the CBS chalkboard, as we called it.
Why don't you describe the CBS chalkboard?
It's a special monitor in the booth with an electronic stylus attached by a small wire. And it's a very simple device wherein the producer decides to use it on a given play. The director puts the chalkboard effect on the line, if you will, which activates Madden's stylus. He then picks up the stylus and draws and speaks at the same time, much as he used to do as a coach for 20 years with various football teams. And when he is finished, he hits a little button up there that erases his squiggles, and that's our cue then to roll the replay and let viewers see what he's just drawn.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Terry O'Neill, and for 15 years he worked for Network Sports as a producer for ABC, then as head of CBS Sports. Now he has his own independent sports TV production company, and he's written a new book called The Game Behind the Game, High Stakes, High Pressure in Television Sports. When you're producing a big sporting event, for instance, a football game, there's hundreds of decisions you have to make per broadcast. Let's go through what some of those typical decisions are. For instance, you have to decide, it's you as the producer, right, who decides when to run an instant replay.
Yes, take the most extreme of all cases where you're doing a Super Bowl and there are 11 videotape machines and you've decided in advance what will be fed to each of those machines on each of the 150 plays in a football game. The moment the play is over, it's imperative, actually even before the play is over, if you can make it that soon, it's imperative to make a decision about whether you want to replay, and if so, which one or ones, because the director needs to know and the commentators need to know immediately, as well as the videotape operators who must re-cue that tape to the start of the play.
So what criteria do you use for making that decision?
Terry, it becomes very intuitive and very instinctive, but the simplest way to say it is you ask yourself, if I were sitting at home watching this in my living room, is there an angle of this play I would like to see? And if I replay it, am I willing to sacrifice the live elements that will be buried under this videotape? Live elements being reaction of players and coaches on the field, a look at the clock, the number of timeouts remaining, all that sort of thing that can be fed to the viewer between plays rather than a replay.
What are some of the other risks of too many replays?
Oh, the real risk is that they become mundane, that they don't deliver any information. And after a while, especially with the video explosion of recent years where people are able to watch so many football games, if your telecast contributes to the clutter of too many replays, you only succeed in numbing the viewer through the course of a weekend. And believe me, there's enough chance to be numb even if everybody puts on nice spare telecasts.
Is it the producer who also decides when to cut for a commercial?
Yes, the league, the National Football League, provides a set of guidelines about when you're allowed to take commercials. But normally there are more opportunities than you need, and therefore, yeah, it's the producer who decides when to take them and when to pass.
So when do you decide to go for a commercial?
Well, you try to space them. You have your clients paying. At CBS, they were paying about $115,000 per 30 seconds for a commercial back in 1985, my last season. And you know that their message, in their terms, should be spread in as broad a spectrum of the clock as possible. So you try not to bunch them if you can avoid that. And then the other determinant is if there's a great live moment, perhaps after the home team has scored and the home fans are going bonkers, you try to save that and get that on the air as best you can and not bury it in a commercial.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also control to an extent how much talk there is from the commentators. Do you think that there should be a constant running commentary?
No, it's one of the real ills of our business is that a football game has become 3 hours of wall-to-wall filibuster anymore. And, you know, the game is so lovely in the stadium. It's punctuated so often by not just crowd roar, but various kinds of gasps and oohs and ahs and all kinds of reaction. The quarterback barking signals, a defensive player trying to react to that. So many lovely things that if we could only get our commentators to be quiet occasionally, you'd get to hear more frequently at home.
Let me put you on the spot and ask you for an example of a bad judgment call that you made during a big game.
I'll tell you about one in my very first Super Bowl, Cincinnati and San Francisco, which was the highest rated game ever, the fourth highest rated television program in history and the highest rated sports event ever. In the third quarter, San Francisco, which had a big lead, was starting to lose ground to Cincinnati, hadn't made a first down through the whole quarter. And just at the end of the quarter, Joe Montana threw a pass to Mike Wilson, who was right on the sideline. Now, this was on the days before television replay actually could be used to reverse a call. But still, there was great curiosity on the viewer's part about whether he had both feet in bounds or not. And that was the primary question to answer. And I didn't. I went to another replay to show, to a chalkboard replay to show another facet of the play. And the moment I did it, I wanted to take it back because in a Super Bowl, a play like that is discussed and rediscussed and hashed over for weeks and weeks after. And you dare not let a moment that might be controversial pass without adjudicating it.
This is an example of learning a lesson the hard way. What were the consequences of your decision?
Surprisingly, a few. The game didn't turn on that play, which is always it's a great fear that television sports producers live with, is that the game will turn, as the New York-Denver Super Bowl did 3 years ago on a play that was not properly replayed by CBS, a play that should have been reversed, a John Elway to Clarence Kay pass. And the poor guys involved in that at CBS have lived with that that frustration for many years now.
In your new book, you talk about the importance of mythologizing the game of football. Why is that important?
It was important, Terry, in order to sell the National Football Conference, because the American Conference was available at the very same time, just across the dial on NBC. And for most viewers, the league is seen as a collective, as just pro football. And what we wanted to do was take the very most attractive teams in our conference, namely the 49ers, the Bears, the Dallas Cowboys, and mythologize them to a degree that they were actually seen as a kind of a league apart or a league within a league as the most attractive teams, the teams that when you check your television listings on Sunday morning, you want to see more than any other.
So what was your approach to making them larger than life for this purpose?
Well, two things, really. One is that we used to open each broadcast with a kind of a mini-movie, if you will, dramatic music and dramatic narration from Pat Summerall, and extreme close-ups of players with the emotion of the game evident on their faces to try to sell personalities and sell the collective mystique of a given team or two. The other thing in that regard was John Madden's terrific ability to seize on a player or a player's personality and make that player, even though he might be quite an ordinary player in a coach's terms, John had an ability to make Bill Bates, for instance, a safety with the Dallas Cowboys, who'd been a free agent, not drafted by any teams. But John liked the way he crashed into kickoff wedges and threw his body around on the field. And John nicknamed him Bully Bill Bates. Went back and found out that his grade school teacher in sixth grade had written on his report card, "Bill Bates is the bully of the schoolyard." And so John called him Bully Bill Bates, even though he was about my size. He was 5'10 and 170 pounds or so.
I figured that while you were busy trying to make myths for the camera, that behind the camera you were doing a lot of debunking.
How do you mean?
Well, that you'd probably make a lot of fun of the myths you'd created.
Oh, I don't know. It would be a manipulation if we'd done that. And I must say that when you're involved in that process, it's different now. I have a longer perspective on it. But when you're involved and you're in that tunnel, doing a game every week and meeting with Joe Montana and Bill Walsh and Tom Landry, you really come to believe that their rivalries are your rivalries and their emotions are yours and their passion is yours. So when you get on the air Sunday, it's not a manipulation at all for you to convey that. I think we convinced ourselves it was holy war on Sundays.
Okay, well, I want to talk with you more about sportscasting on producing sports for television. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Terry O'Neill, who is a former producer for both CBS and ABC, now has his own company, and he's the author of The Game Behind the Game. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Terry O'Neill worked for network TV sports for 15 years, first as a producer for ABC, then as head of CBS Sports, and he's produced broadcasts of the Super Bowl, Monday Night Football, and the Olympics. He now has his own TV production company, and he's written a new book called The Game Behind the Game, High Stakes, High Pressure in Television Sports. Let's talk a little bit about some of the sports casters that you've worked with. You created the team of Pat Summerall and John Madden. What did you see in them that you thought would work together?
You know, we knew that Madden in 1981 would be our new number one analyst. There was a debate, however, within CBS about whether Pat Summerall or Vin Scully was right to partner him. And Scully, while my colleagues argued is a more elegant broadcaster, perhaps, was a man who needed much of the microphone in order to be effective. And Madden, of course, is among the most expansive broadcasters in sports. And I argued that together it would be a pairing that would just wear the viewer out within 3 weeks, whereas Summerall is so spare and so economical that he'd be the right stylist, the right partner for John. And after some debate within the division, we won that argument.
There's a scene in the movie Broadcast News that you say in your new book you really relate to, and I'm thinking of the scene where William Hurt is broadcasting from a breaking news story, and Holly Hunter is basically whispering in his ear what to say and what questions to ask the newsmakers that he's interviewing, and after the broadcast is over, William Hurt says to Holly Hunter, "You know just when to feed me the lines." Now, this apparently is the kind of position you were in a lot, producing sports, feeding things to the announcers. What kinds of things would you have to tell them?
Terry, it was sometimes a matter of seeing a pass route in isolation, for instance. And even before the replay, telling Madden, for instance, "John, watch this post corner move," or "John, it's a pattern called the shake that we were told about yesterday by Joe Montana," which enabled Madden to actually preview or anticipate the replay for the viewer. And while he may or may not have seen it himself from the booth, it enabled him to look like an absolute omniscient genius up there, having seen all the play and the individual matchups on every sequence, even before the viewer saw it on the replay. It only added to his legend as the authority in pro football.
Did the opposite ever happen, where you told him something that was incorrect and he felt like an idiot?
That's happened to me in my career, but not with John. By the time I got to that point, I knew, and every producer knows, that his credibility and the commentator's willingness to repeat your information is totally contingent upon your 100% delivery of accuracy in every situation. Because, of course, when the commentator makes a mistake, he's not able to say, or we don't super on the screen, "That mistake came to you from the producer, Terry O'Neill." So it was by the time I got to CBS, I knew it was critical that I be certain in every situation.
What's an example of an error that you made before?
Oh, you'll enjoy this. When I was a statistician at ABC for Monday Night Football, just after I'd finished my Olympic research duties and I was going to graduate school, I was sitting in Frank Gifford's side with a team of Gifford, Meredith, and Cosell. And one night in Philadelphia, as the Eagles were attempting to score late in the half, I told Frank that the Eagles had no more timeouts left. And so in a pause during their last timeout, Frank went into a long explanation about how they'd have to throw the next pass either into the end zone or to the sideline because they didn't have time to stop the clock in case they completed a pass in the middle of the field. Well, don't you know that on the next snap, the Eagle receiver took about a 10-yard pass down to about the 5-yard line, and he jumped up having caught the ball and signaled for timeout, and the official gave it to him. And Frank chilled me with a look. He's a very nice man and been a friend a long time, but he has never looked at me quite like he did in that moment, and I certainly deserved it.
Let's talk a little bit about how television has changed sports. One of the complaints that you hear sometimes is that games are now played for the cameras and not for the fans in the stands.
I think it's accurate to some degree, although, interestingly, the United States Football League, the spring league that lasted just 3 years in the early 80s, failed in large measure because when you saw the game on television, there was no one in the stands, and therefore the viewer in his subconscious or maybe his conscious mind decided this must not be important. If there are not full stadiums there and no one to see it, how important can it be? Is it worth my time?
Another criticism that you frequently hear about how network sports has changed television is that the time of the game is created not for the convenience of the athlete or for the convenience of the people in the stands, but rather for the broadcast. So on certain games, whether it's East Coast or West Coast, it's going to be played at a certain time, you know, one set time, and it might be really inconvenient for the people in that location.
You know, this is one that I think is ultimately defensible if you understand that the players are now making scores of money beyond what they ever would have dreamed before television. The average NBA player, the average player, is now making $700,000 a year. Just 20 years ago, that same average player was making $9,000 a year. I think the truth is it's not terribly inconvenient for television to dictate certain kickoff and play ball schedules. And interestingly, at the Seoul Olympics here just last year, when NBC tried to dictate the start of track and field events because Seoul was 14 hours different from New York, it was rebuffed by the International Track and Field Federation. Likewise, in swimming and volleyball and several other sports, television did not have its way, and the decisions were made on the welfare of the athlete.
Do you think that the pacing of games is ever affected by the demands of the television broadcast?
They are, but athletes have come to not only to recognize that, but to use the time effectively. Basketball coaches, for instance, will tell you that they know there'll be a television timeout every 4 or 5 minutes on the game clock, and therefore they make their decisions about when to take their own timeouts, knowing that they'll have these other stoppages. Many times they can save their own timeouts for the end of the game and use the TV timeouts to rest players and do strategy because they know when they're coming.
The networks aren't in this game alone anymore. There's a lot of competition now from cable. As a matter of fact, as an independent producer, you produce frequently for cable now. What impact do you think this is having on network sports?
It's Terry, the single biggest impact is the erosion of audience. When I first got into the business, we'd sit down in programming meetings and know that we could offer some weak programming occasionally, knowing that the audience had nowhere else to go. And especially if we tucked a weak program between two stronger ones, we often got away with it. Now, if you don't give the audience something it wants to see, it can go and find cable and syndicated programming, and even more alarming, it can find other things to do. During the football strike of 1982 and 1987, the networks found in a dramatic way that people were able to get through the fall of the year, believe it or not, without watching football every Sunday. And so it's made it tougher in terms of the need to offer quality programming at all times if one wants to attract an audience.
What's the difference in the amount of money that baseball and football make for the networks?
In terms of profit?
Yeah.
When I was at CBS in 5 years, as we mentioned in the book, NFL football made CBS $91.8 million. CBS has just signed a baseball agreement, which begins next year, for $1.08 billion for 4 years of baseball. And already its executives are admitting it will lose in the area of $20 to $40 million a year on that. Even before the first pitch is thrown, they're making that admission. But they've done so poorly in primetime entertainment programming lately that they feel it's necessary to, in effect, purchase dominance in the month of October when they've bought the League Championship Series and the World Series.
Since the networks have to bid for contracts, do you ever feel that commentators can't really be as critical of the people in the sport as they might like to be for fear of alienating the league and losing a contract?
Yeah, there's no question. In this respect, sports television is an embarrassment to those of us who like to think we could practice a little journalism there. Take the recent NCAA basketball tournament. If you watch CBS's 60 Hours, you would think that every student athlete is going to class with regularity. Everyone is progressing toward a degree, that when the games finish at the end of March, they're all headed back to the classroom. And yet in the very same weeks that you're watching this fantasy on television, you're seeing a Time magazine cover story about the ills of college athletics called the College Trap. The New York Times is editorializing, calling college athletics a cesspool. And yet CBS, when you tune it in, it's like going to see a fantasy movie. You have to suspend belief for the 2 hours that you're watching the game, because what you're hearing has no touch and no relevance to reality at all.
Well, how do you feel about having been one of the people who created the fantasy?
Well, I have to say that one of the reasons I'm no longer in network television is because I frequently rebelled at that fantasy, and it made for controversy and contention all along the way between me and my bosses. I ultimately pushed to the wall on many of these subjects, would take my own career in my hands and report the truth, knowing that the reaction from a rights holder might indeed be enough to get me fired.
You are now the head of your own sports TV production company. Do you ever miss the high pressure and the big games that you covered for the networks?
I really don't, Terry. I must tell you that if you do it long enough and you try very hard while you're doing it, once you've left it, it's quite easy to decompress, mm-hmm. And to know that you took a very full swing at it, and you left behind some good people, and perhaps you trained some people and put good systems in place, and that they're now doing what you once did. I think if you take any less than that sort of approach to it, you might leave with misgivings or regrets, but no, I have none, whatever.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
You're kind to have me. Thank you.
My guest has been Terry O'Neill, former sports producer at ABC, former head of CBS Sports, now the head of his own sports production company. Terry O'Neill has written a new book called The Game Behind the Game. It's published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with writer Joyce Johnson. Her new novel, In the Night Café, is set in the New York bohemian art and literary scene of the late 50s and early 60s. During that time in her own life, Johnson was involved with Jack Kerouac, a relationship she wrote about in her earlier book, Minor Characters. Johnson is now a contributing editor for Vanity Fair magazine. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the Banooski Museum of Nature's Innovative Arts. It's home to a wide collection of stillborn freaks preserved in jars, all the creation of Catherine Dunn, author of the new novel Geek Love. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward examines how the 60s treated one of the founders of rock and roll, Chuck Berry. And book critic John Leonard reviews On the Golden Porch, the new collection of short stories by Tatiana Tolstoya. Tolstoya can claim Leo Tolstoy as a distant relative, but Leonard says Tolstoya's writing is more closely related to John Updike and John Cheever. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Despite massive irregularities at the polls, President Bush said today that the opposition won a clear-cut, overwhelming victory in Panama's presidential elections, and he called on Panamanian General Manuel Noriega to honor the will of his people. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
President Bush would not discuss what action he might take if Noriega ignores the U.S. call and has his hand-picked candidate declared the winner. But earlier today, the White House said it was considering a range of options from military to economic. Officials admit none is attractive. More economic sanctions would permanently cripple Panama. And former President Jimmy Carter warned today American military involvement would alienate the people of Panama and play into Noriega's hands. Carter met with President Bush today on his return from Panama, where he was an election observer. U.S. officials say President Bush may send in more U.S. troops to add pressure to Noriega, show the opposition it has support, and defend U.S. personnel or the canal should either be threatened. While risky, this plan does not involve the direct removal of Noriega with military force. That is not an option now, though officials say it could be in the future. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
In Panama, the Noriega regime is sticking to its claim of victory in Sunday's election, despite growing criticism from other Latin American governments. More from NPR's Tom Jelton in Panama City.
Peruvian President Alan Garcia today released a letter in which he calls on other Latin presidents to join in a concerted action to defend Panamanian democracy. One South American ambassador told NPR today the feeling in the diplomatic corps is that the Noriega regime lost the election. Another ambassador from a leading South American nation said Sunday's election was, quote, a gigantic, vulgar fraud, unquote. And he said the new government may not be recognized by its Latin neighbors. But the Noriega regime is so far standing firm in spite of the criticism. Aquilino Boyd, vice presidential candidate on the government ticket, said today, quote, we lament that some of our Latin brothers have joined the U.S. crowd and are involving themselves in Panama's internal affairs, unquote. Boyd acknowledged there may have been fraud in Sunday's election, but he said they were minor incidents, like what used to happen in Chicago under Mayor Daley, he said. In Panama City, I'm Tom Jelton.
Forces loyal to Guatemala's government put down an attempted coup today. The leaders of the attempt are now in jail. In Washington, the State Department said no shooting or casualties have been reported. Traffic is returning to normal, and radio and television stations have resumed normal broadcasts. Guatemala was ruled by a long line of brutal military regimes before the current civilian president, Vinicio Cerezo, took office 3 years ago. Cerezo survived a coup attempt last year. Six sailors were killed today and five injured when a fire broke out in the engine room of a U.S. Navy supply ship in the South China Sea. The fire aboard the USS White Plains was the second shipboard accident to claim the lives of American sailors in 3 weeks. 47 sailors were killed in an explosion in a gun turret on the battleship Iowa last month. Today's accident occurred as the White Plains was steaming home from a deployment supporting Persian Gulf operations. South Korean authorities today issued arrest warrants for 90 dissidents in a crackdown following the deaths of six policemen last week in battles with student radicals. President No Tae-woo told a special cabinet meeting today that the fate of the country hinges on whether law and order can be maintained. Leaders of the political opposition, however, say police incite much of the violence by using too much force, and some opposition legislators are calling for a limit on the use of tear gas. Secretary of State James Baker met in Helsinki today with Finnish President Mauno Koivisto. Baker is on his way to Moscow for meetings with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell just over 5 points, closing at 2371.33. Advances led declines 4-3. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Most of Chuck Berry's best-known songs were written between 1955 and 1959, Maybelline, Johnny Be Good, and Sweet Little 16, though he may have been working on these songs even earlier. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says for the most part, after that period, Berry's career deteriorated due to an unfortunate series of events.
Have mercy! I'm in a world of trouble now. By the state patrol. I am charged with traffic of the forbidden, and I almost finish doing my parole.
In 1959, Chuck Berry was arrested and charged with a violation of the Mann Act, transporting a minor across state lines for the purposes of engaging in immoral activities. In retrospect, it looks like he may have been set up, and certainly the trials involved had more than their share of racism. The first one was thrown out for just that reason. But the bottom line was that he didn't enter a recording studio between 1960 and 1964. Although only a year of that time was spent in jail, nobody wanted any association with Chuck Berry. The poet laureate of teenage America was finally released into a world much different than the one he'd left. Pop music was now dominated by the British, of all people, and both the Beatles and the Rolling Stones acknowledged their debt to him. The Stones guitarist, Keith Richards, wouldn't have had a career if it hadn't been for Berry's guitar style, in fact. It was a miracle. His songs had been in the public ear, even if he hadn't. On January 14, 1964, he ran into the studio and started recording.
As I got on a city bus and found a vacant seat, I thought I saw my future bride walking up the street. I shouted to the driver, "Hey, conductor, you must slow down. I think I see her. Please let me off the bus."
First came a story of pursuing a girl, pretty much a rewrite of Maybelline, the song that had made him famous, but with a strong new melody. Next, he considered the teenagers he'd written about in the past. Surely they'd grown up some, so he fantasized a continuation of their story.
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished him well. You could see that Pierre did truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell.
Sheer optimism, a refutation of the truism that teenage marriages don't work, and proof that this is a great country. And while he waited for the record company to get around to pressing and promoting his first post-jail releases, he recorded a song that was such a deep expression of love for America that it's inflamed passions all around the world.
Home in Norfolk, Virginia, California, on my mind. I straddled that Greyhound and rode him into Raleigh and on across Carolina. We stopped in Charlotte, the bypass Rock Hill. We never was a minute late. We was 90 miles out of Atlanta by sundown, rolling out of Georgia State. We had motor trouble and turned into a struggle halfway across Alabama. And that hound broke down.
Promised Land was a picture of Chuck Berry's America, where the South wasn't such a hot place to be if you were black, but people helped each other out, and California was the Promised Land. Some Promised Land, each of these records stiffed. Caught between Anglophilia and the moral fervor that had swept radio in the wake of the Paola hearings, this middle-aged ex-jailbird didn't have a chance. He continued to record great songs, No Particular Place to Go, Dear Dad, It Wasn't Me, but they didn't sell. In 1966, Chess Records, for whom he'd recorded from the beginning, let him go, and he signed with Mercury, where he re-recorded his old hits with a listless backing band. In 1967, he recorded live at the Fillmore Auditorium, backed by the Steve Miller Band, and that didn't even do him any good. Lucky thing he had some money coming in from the old songs, if not a whole lot, thanks to his contract. Chess re-signed him in 1969, and early the next year, a single came out. One side was Have Mercy, Judge, and the other, this bizarre tale.
Julian and Johnny opened a novelty shop. Back under the counter was the cream of the crop. Everything was clicking and the business was good. Till one day, lo and behold, an officer stood. Johnny jumped the counter, but he stumbled and fell. But Julian made it over. Johnny felt that he yelled, go ahead on, Julian. He can't catch up with you, go, Julian. He ain't mad enough for you, go, Julian. Use all the speed you got, go, Julian. You know you need a lot, go, Julian. He lagging behind, go ahead on, Julian.
Here was the same Johnny, Chuck Berry's alter ego who'd starred in Johnny B. Goode and Bye Bye Johnny, selling pornography under the counter and getting caught like the guy in Have Mercy, Judge. Ironically, Chess made big money on Chuck Berry the second time around when he rewrote an obscure doo-wop record called Toy Bell and recorded it live as My Ding-a-Ling. It's sickening to his old fans, but it was the only number one record of his career. Great songwriters occasionally lose their way, but few have ever dissolved in bitterness and cynicism the way Chuck Berry has. While writing this piece, I thought of another great black musician who's in jail right now, James Brown. Let's hope he handles his post-prison career differently.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. A carnival works because people pay to feel amazed and scared, says one of the characters in Catherine Dunn's new novel, Geek Love. Some novelists complain about a lack of attention from their publishers, but Catherine Dunn has no complaints in that area. Geek Love was the first book purchased by Sonny Mehta after he became president and editor-in-chief of Knopf, and Knopf has invested considerable money in promoting this new book. Geek Love is the story of a carnival couple, Al and Lil Banuski, who decide to breed their own freak show by experimenting with insecticides, illicit and prescription drugs, and radioisotopes during each of Lil's pregnancies. Lil says, what greater gift can you give your children than an inherent ability to earn a living by just being themselves? The story is narrated by one of Al and Lil's children, Olympia.
My father spared no expense in these experiments. My mother had been liberally dosed with cocaine, amphetamines, and arsenic during her ovulation and throughout her pregnancy with me. It was a disappointment when I emerged with such commonplace deformities. My albinism is the regular pink-eyed variety, and my hump, though pronounced, is not remarkable in size or shape as humps go. My situation was far too humdrum to be marketable on the same scale as my brothers and sisters. Still, my parents noted that I had a strong voice and decided I might be an appropriate shill and talker for the business. A bald albino hunchback seemed the right enticement toward the esoteric talents of the rest of the family. The dwarfism, which was very apparent by my third birthday, came as a pleasant surprise to the patient pair and increased my value.
I'm going to ask you to describe the Banuski Museum of Nature's Innovative Art.
This is the family shrine, which the Banuskis refer to as the chute. And over the years, it becomes a kind of museum of the bizarre in which they have stuffed featherless chickens, two-headed cats, five-legged calves, and so on. But the core of the chute is what was also the purpose for designing the chute in the first place, and that is the 20-gallon jars in which are stored permanently the unsuccessful experiments of Al and Lil, who are the children who they had modified through these chemical techniques, who did not survive.
What got you thinking about freaks?
Well, I think that like many, and perhaps most, young people, when I was young, I felt myself to be very much an outsider. And as I go through life, I see that a lot of people have that feeling of being always outside, never quite belonging. How many of us have come through life totally disaffected toward our own physiques? You know, none of us look like the current fashion model of the time. Even fashion models themselves are in a kind of constant struggle with their own bodies to attain some kind of ideal, which exists perhaps only in their mind or maybe only in a Pepsi-Cola ad. But it's that kind of constant feeling of we are all freaks inside. There's always that sense of isolation and of not quite fitting in, whether it's physical, mental, or through our personalities.
Well, you're talking about freak as metaphor. I'm wondering if your book, you also did some research on people who were born deformed and ended up being the exhibits in freak shows.
I did do some research on that. And one of the basic concepts for me in this book is that my characters are not disabled. My characters are not handicapped. They are uniquely gifted. And the fact that they are uniquely gifted is primarily based on how they think of themselves. Most people in our society would look at them and think, oh, these poor people, they're disfigured, they're deformed, they're handicapped. Well, they're not. They're extremely hardworking, talented, intelligent people who make an extremely good living for themselves. And, you know, there may be moral questions about what they're doing and why they're doing it in many cases. But that has nothing to do with their functionality as people.
Now, you had a strange job as the author of this book because you had to design all the deformities that you gave to your characters. I think of you as having this deformity notebook with all these characters with different deformities and taking one out and thinking, no, that won't work, and substituting another.
Well, actually, I didn't need to do that. They kind of sprang full-blown from Zeus's ear, if you know what I mean. They each were created more or less in response to the necessity of the story.
Give us an example of how you designed a character for the role they were going to play in the novel.
Well, young Fortunato, for example, known throughout the book as the Chick, is the only child who is born to the Banuskis, apparently completely normal in physique. And this was, just on the most superficial level, an obvious opportunity to take that reversal of standards and to show this child who looks normal to the rest of us and would be perfectly acceptable in the average grade school and not cause any but the most pleasant reactions is viewed by the Banuskis as a terrible failure. And I needed to reverse that standard, and I needed Chick and his normal physique to emphasize the fact that the standards within this family are based on their attractions for the sideshow. But in order to make him interesting to me, I gave him the power of telekinesis, the ability to move things with his mind, so that there would be yet that other element of great power that could play its role in the plot.
Geek Love is your third novel, and this book is published by Knopf. And they've really invested, I think, a lot of money in advertising the book and promoting it. And I'm wondering if you're feeling at all pressured by that, that you have to live up to everything that's been invested in the book.
Well, it's in a way, it's kind of strange. The book was so much a part of my life for so long that when I finished it, I really grieved. I felt as though I had lost this family. I'd lost this whole world that I'd created, but that had become very real to me. And by the time the book was actually published, I had gone through that kind of long separation process in which editing takes place and planning takes place. And Knopf had been very, very good to me, I have to say. They're really nice people to work with. But by the time the book comes out, I really feel as though it's so disassociated from me that, in a way, it doesn't concern me. I'm glad if Knopf is pleased with the fact that they're into their third printing now, 6 weeks after the book came out. And of course I'm delighted that it's doing well. But But in a way, you know what I mean, Terry? It's not personal. It doesn't seem to affect me.
You know, in addition to writing novels, you also write about boxing for the Associated Press. How did you start writing about boxing?
I began writing about boxing in late 1980 when I went to my first live boxing match, or soon after that. I had always been a kind of boxing fan in a lighthearted way because in my family, boxing was just one of the sports that we all enjoyed. But I had never been to a live match until 1980. And I was so stunned by the difference in this live performance from the kind of hygienic and anesthetic versions that you get over television that I was really swept away. And I looked to the newspaper the following day to find out what the reporters thought that they had seen. And, of course, there was almost no coverage whatsoever. And that really stunned me. So I went to the local alternative newspaper here, Willamette Week, and offered to write regular boxing coverage for them. It was one of those things where I decided that if I was a writer and I wanted this written about, I would have to write it.
Was it ever hard for you to get access to boxers or to break in as a boxing correspondent? It's such a male world.
No, actually, it's a tremendous advantage to be a female in this exclusively male world. Because commonly, even though boxing people, and I'm going to make a terrible generalization here, tend to come from fairly uneducated backgrounds and tend to be pretty chauvinistic in some ways, their basic tenet and the whole premise of their lives is their obsession with this wonderful, bizarre, and terrible sport. If you could box, they wouldn't care if you were a baboon. And if you are willing to write about boxing and are willing to do your homework, they don't really care. They forget all about it. There's that little glitch when a boxing person first realizes that he's talking boxing with a woman. And then it's just a little momentary hitch in the conversation. And then he forgets because all he's really interested in is the sport.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. It's really been a pleasure.
Catherine Dunn's new novel, Geek Love, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Tonight we'll talk with Alaska's environmental chief, Dennis Kelso, who's in Washington to testify on Capitol Hill. He accuses Exxon of disinformation regarding the use of dispersants on the first weekend of the oil spill in Prince William Sound. Exxon says it could have cleaned up half the oil there had it been given permission to go ahead with dispersants. Also, the U.S. Army attempts to improve the physical competence of recruits, many of whom cannot do the standard 13 military-style push-ups. And Bob Mondello reviews a new film called Listen to Me. It's a film about college students and a debate over abortion.
Thanks, Noah. That and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. On the Golden Porch is the first collection of short stories by the Russian writer Tatiana Tolstoya. Tolstoya was in this country last week promoting her book, but she's a resident of Moscow, and as her name suggests, she's from a family of famous Russian authors. Book critic John Leonard has a review of her debut work.
Because she doesn't write in the lofty manner of War and Peace, Tatiana Tolstoya can't be compared by the critics to her great-granduncle Leo. And because she doesn't write in hack obeisance to a Stalin, she can't be compared to her grandfather, Alexei. But because she writes short, everybody's comparing her to Chekhov. This is silly. If Tolstoya sounds like anybody specifically Russian in this luminous collection of stories, it's the novelist Bulgakov, or the poet Mandelstam, or any one of the fantasts of the Silver Age of Russian lit between 1905 and Bolshevism, like Andrei Bely. Like Bely, in fact, she writes mostly of the city of the Winter Palace, except that it's Leningrad now instead of St. Petersburg, where metaphors flash like firebirds in the night sky. And because she writes of the very young and very old, memory and illusion, passionate beginnings and love gone wrong, magic and failure, she will remind American readers most of all of John Cheever for the sadness and John Updike for those tricks of language by which that sadness surprises itself into celebration. Somehow, she bounces. What are we to make, for instance, of poor Pipka, whose story of herself is so wild and confused? Something, and I quote, about wanting to go to drama school, even being accepted. But at the market she ran into pickled garlic vendors and was taken away, gagged, to Baku, in a white Volga without license plates. There they violated her, knocked out half her teeth, and abandoned her naked on the seashore in a puddle of oil. In the morning she allegedly was found by a wild tribesman passing through Baku, who took her to his mountain eyrie and kept her there all summer, feeding her melon from knife point through a crack in the cabin wall. In the fall, he traded her to a passing ethnographer for a watch without hands. This certainly isn't Chekhov, but nobody listens to Pipka anyway. She wasn't a person, was she? Nobody listens to the storytellers, the dreamers, the old babysitter who once upon a time, before the revolution, had been young and cherished, the bachelor in love with the recorded voice of a singer gone to seed, the shy librarian who loses his heart and his wallet, Rima, who had heard, quote, the future whispering to her alone. She had been promised every wreath, flower, island, and rainbow, and where were they now? They're all of them lonely in their crowded communal apartments. Time is their problem, not ideology. Nobody listens but Tolstoya, who lets their hearts fly out of their mouths and play in the mountain light and wind. No wonder they wouldn't let this woman into the Moscow Writers' Union last year. She keeps on opening windows. Maybe there's something after all of the 19th century great-granduncle in her, a little Leo. Quote, the clock was ticking, fruit compote floated in a glass pitcher, and his slippers had grown cold overnight. Old Peters pushed the window frame. The blue glass rang. 1,000 yellow birds flew up, and the naked golden spring cried, laughing, catch me, catch me. And wanting nothing, regretting nothing, Peters smiled gratefully at life, running past, indifferent, ungrateful, treacherous, mocking, meaningless alien, marvelous, marvelous, marvelous.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed On the Golden Porch by Tatiana Tolstoya. Here's a look at the next fresh air. David Shields has a gift for language as a novelist, but speaking is always a challenge. Next time, Shields discusses his new novel, Dead Languages. The main character has a stutter, like Shields, and Shields has come to think of stuttering as a metaphor for the difficulty of all communication. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of historic recordings of Gilbert and Sullivan operettas. And guest commentator Eileen Segalov takes a personal and historical look at Mother's Day. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Laura Civitz. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.